Welcome, listeners, to another episode of the Indian Cycling Podcast brought to you by The Bike Affair.
This is your co-host, Gokul. I still continue to host it alone without Harsha as he is busy with work. Today, I have a very special guest with me, Kamal Kasturi, a very good friend who I really admire for having followed his passion against quite a lot of difficulties. I knew Kamal long time ago as a runner in Hyderabad. He also took up cycling, and one of the first things that attracted me to him was the fact that he had taken pains in assembling a bike from various components together in those days, which was not He is also a leading photographer, and during this phase, I saw him lose a lot of weight, and in fact, he came to the point that he was almost unrecognizable. Somehow, during this phase, I believe he reflected back on his childhood, and he was very intrigued by child health from a broader perspective, and he's pursuing his PhD from the Friedman School of Nutrition, Science and Policy at Tufts in Boston. Welcome, Kamal. It's a pleasure having you on the podcast.
Hi, Gokul, and hi, listeners. Thank you so much for having me here.
So, I hope I have covered a majority of the things, but you can fill up the gaps and also tell us a bit more about your PhD and interests.
Yeah, I mean, I think you have covered everything. Except for the fact that I no longer do a lot of physical activity, primarily because work keeps me very busy. And with the whole COVID situation, I've been able to actually come back to India. So my days start pretty early, and then they also end pretty late because I have calls with colleagues in the US, and I just have no motivation to drag myself out the next day morning to go for a run. And I live with my parents, so I'm a little concerned about exposing them to the virus by going out. So that is my other excuse for not being more physically active, which I would like to be. But at the same time, I really am watching what I eat. That is a part of my training at Friedman. So I'm quite careful about what I eat. So even though I've not been able to exercise a whole lot, I've been able to control my weight. And as far as my research interests, it really revolves around diets, about what people eat, why they eat what they eat, and what are the drivers of food security or insecurity, however you like to put it. Basically, things like poverty and other economic setbacks that don't allow people to consume healthy diets. That is really what I'm very interested in. And my thesis is going to be on infant young child feeding practices, which includes both exclusive breastfeeding and continued breastfeeding and complementary feeding, which is a period from 6 to 23 months. And the project is based in Jordan.
You are working across three different geographies now, between Boston, India, and Jordan.
Yeah, actually, the project hasn't kicked off yet because of the COVID situation in Jordan too. So a lot of the work that we are doing is through Zoom and online meetings. And we have an in-country partner who actually is stuck in Jordan and cannot go back to the US. So it's working out well for us. And he is able to do the things that we need the project to do at this point in time. And hopefully sometime, I don't know, maybe April, May, we'll be able to travel to Jordan, and that may present an opportunity for me to travel there.
To kickstart things, there is a famous quote that you cannot out-train a bad diet. I think many cyclists do not understand or accept this. So what are your thoughts on this, Kamal?
Yeah, I mean, since we are on quotes, Gokul, I'm reminded of Michael Pollan's famous quote, which says, eat food, not too much, and mostly plants. I know this is going to open a whole can of worms, but I personally have been vegan for over 4 years now. Actually, I'll be 5 next month. And there is enough evidence to support this statement, and athletes can be on plant-based diets and still have a wholesome nutrition. On the quote that you made, I must agree with you that you definitely cannot out-train a bad diet. I am not a registered dietitian by training, but I definitely have some understanding of nutrition, and I'm going to try and answer as many questions based on some of the research that is available and is upcoming. When I was training and I was training hard, I remember that training was essentially, broken down into three buckets. That was the training, the activity itself that you were doing, which was running, cycling, swimming, whatever it may be, then nutrition, and then rest. And I've often seen, even when I was training, that most athletes, both recreational and people who want to be a little serious and want to be competitive, usually miss at least one, if not two, components of training. Either their nutrition is poor, or they end up overtraining and don't provide their bodies adequate rest. And if you don't have all these three things together, it's likely that your training is not going to be as good as you want it to be. You might hit a plateau, or the worst thing would be you would be overtraining and probably end up getting some kind of a injury. So I think it is really critical from a performance point of view about what kind of diet you consume. And there is a lot of research that is available now that suggests that you want to take in fewer refined carbs, replace them with more whole grains, eat more fruits and vegetables. The US recommendations, and in fact even the World Health Organization recommendations, are roughly 3 cups of vegetables a day and 2 cups of fruits a day. Restrict your intake of red meat if you're a meat eater, because of the cardiovascular risk, and also just to the environment. And then you could replace that with consuming more seafood, because it has a lot of omega-3s, which are really important for our body. Reducing your sugar intake are some of the things that I think are essential to fuel your body.
Good. So why did you turn vegan, Kamal?
A couple of reasons. One is I had these bunch of conversations with friends along a certain period in my life about 4 years ago, where the conversations revolved around some ethical practices about, don't wear fur or don't use exotic animal leather. And then I began to question, you were fine with, you know, eating lamb or chicken or seafood, but you were not fine with, you know, killing of a crocodile for its skin, or snake for its skin, or deer for its skin, or, you know. And then I was like, wait, there is so much hypocrisy around this. And at the same time, I was also reflecting on how to live a more sustainable life, and understood animal agriculture causes a lot of both methane production and in terms of just resources, I mean the natural resources which are limited to us. And I think that was the reason why I decided to primarily turn vegetarian. I was eating meat at that point in time. And then I, with the hope of turning vegan, I turned vegetarian because I didn't know if I would have the will to turn vegan entirely. And during that time when I was vegetarian, I read a lot about the dairy industry, and I think I decided that being vegan would mean that from an ethical standpoint of view, I would feel better that I was not exercising the choice of killing an animal for it to be on my plate. And from a sustainability point of view for the environment, which is something very, which is very dear to me in some of the research that I'm interested in, you know, also was complementary to the ethical part. So I think those are the reasons why I turned vegan, and I continue to be vegan, and I hope I will stay vegan for the rest of my life.
So I was hoping that you would say it is because of the nutritional aspect. So you disappointed me, Kamal.
Well, I mean, you can. Being plant-based has definite advantages, no doubt. But and you can see that a lot of serious athletes now, professional athletes now, are turning plant-based. A good example is the Game Changers. I think a documentary that was made on Netflix and gained a lot of popularity. I think even a common household name, Virat Kohli, now is follows a plant-based diet. I don't know if he's vegan, but he definitely follows a plant-based diet, and he has only spoken highly of his levels of energy and his performance being improved since he's turned plant-based.
Cool. Yeah, I was just joking. So, in fact, I am also vegan, so, but I have always been vegetarian. However, for more for from the point of view of my digestional needs, I also turned vegan and stopped dairy. But I guess we'll discuss that later in the podcast. So the next thing that I wanted to discuss was I since I coach people, I many times come across goals which are quite unique or quite different from what is traditional. And one such goal was the fact that he was able to ride a certain distance, about 70 kilometers, without having to eat any anything. And his goal was that a short-term goal was to reach 100 kilometers without having to eat anything. So as such, as a goal, this was not bad, of course, and it was not a big time goal. It was more like a short term goal, and he had many other bigger goals to achieve. But I realized when he explained this need that his approach to nutrition had to change from looking at it as general food to looking at it as a fuel to reach his to give him the energy to complete the activities that he wanted. So I often feel that eating the right food at the right time is important for weight loss and for performance and stuff like that, you know? So what are your thoughts on this around the timing of food and the fact that some people think about doing fasted rides or fasted runs and so on?
I think there are a few questions that you've asked that need to be unpacked here. And from what I hear, from what you just said, I'm not sure if this cyclist wants to really concentrate on weight loss, but merely want to be able to push himself to be able to ride 100 kilometers without using any nutrition.
Yeah, it was this part. He was not, though he was interested in weight loss, this particular goal was more like a personal challenge that he wanted to undertake to be able to push himself to do 100K without eating.
Okay, so I mean, this might be a little technical, but riding for 100 kilometers without eating anything is definitely challenging in several ways, but I'd like to like break it down.
Okay.
So basically all the carbohydrate that we consume is broken down and is stored as glycogen in our body. About 400 kilocalories of glycogen is stored in our liver and can be converted to blood glucose to supply the body with energy whenever we need it. And about 1400 kilocalories of glycogen is stored in muscles during activities like running, cycling, any high intensity activity or endurance activity that you may undertake. So you have roughly about maybe between 2600 to 2800 kilocalories of glycogen that is stored in our bodies, right? So the thing is about when you do long, intense activities like sort of ultra marathoning or, you know, even running even cycling for 100 kilometers, it isn't really like a 100 meter race. So these are activities that you spend a considerable amount of time in. So actually for all the activities that we spend a considerable time doing them, we usually want to train our bodies to be able to use fat as opposed to this readily available glycogen to fuel us, right? So when you are able to train your muscles to use more fat instead of using the available glycogen, a few things happen. When you're working out in the aerobic zone, as we call it, you know, the oxygen availability to the muscles increases, so the athlete is able to use more fat for fuel readily and is able to conserve more of the glycogen for when it is needed. But here's the catch to it. This is based off of the fact that if you are only operating at sort of 50 to 60% of your VO2 max, then your body is able to use most of the fat that is available to fuel that workout. But the minute you increase your activity to go beyond that level of intensity to say 70 to 80% of your VO2 max, that is like, you know, running a 3 hour marathon or trying to ride a bike in maybe three and a half hours where you are riding at a pretty high pace and are unable to keep your intensity to below 60% of your VO2 max, then the person is not able to metabolize fat as soon, as quickly as he would like to, and is actually using up his glycogen in the body, his reserves of glycogen in the body. And there could come a point somewhere where you would hit the famous wall that all endurance athletes keep speaking about, because he's basically depleted all the energy in his body and he has nothing else to fuel him further. So it would be interesting to know what this athlete that you speak about is trying to achieve, right? Is he riding at 50% of his VO2 max and is going on a leisure ride and just wants to conserve energy and train his body to be able to ride 100 kilometers without supplemental nutrition, or he wants to ride out this big fast ride in 3 hours or so without supplemental food? And I think that is going to probably do more harm to him because he is going to deplete all his glycogen stores in his body and risks probably hitting the wall and having to stop his ride entirely.
Yeah, I think so when we had this goal discussion, we were looking at doing a ultra endurance ride which was spanning 4 or 5 days. So I think what he was probably looking at it from the point of view of if I want to do a ride which spans multiple days, whether he will be able to do it, you know, improve his efficiency and be able to do it on lesser nutritional support. So probably that's what he was trying to evaluate, is my guess.
I personally feel if this was going to be sort of a multi-day ride, I think it definitely wouldn't be wise for him to go for extended periods without nutrition. Because once your glycogen in the body is depleted, it actually takes between 2 and 3 days for it to refill. So he probably is risking bonking on day two, if not day three, right? So if he is definitely looking at a multi-day ride, I think, as you made the point, he is better served by consuming nutrition adequately, which could be sort of like 7 to 8 kilocalories per body weight per hour, right? So let's say if we are talking about, I don't know, like if you're talking about a 60 kilo person, maybe he should be looking at about taking in about 300 to 400 calories every hour to have enough energy to get through with his ride or any other activity that he has planned.
Cool. I think that shift in perspective is what the point that I wanted to bring across, that to look at the food as a fuel part for your activity and to plan it out accordingly and ensure that you are able to last the entire event. So the another interesting goal that I had, or conversation which I had with another athlete, was while we are looking at the progress this person had made, one of the things that came across was that his sleep was significantly affected, and that was affecting the quality of the workouts and in terms the and in also the improvements that we were trying to get. So we were trying to break down on why his sleep quality was poor, and two things came across. One was few days after a hard ride, he was very uncomfortable on the bike because he was very young and he had outgrown his bike. So that was causing him issues some days. And on other occasions, he was also having some gastric issues, which was making it difficult to sleep in the night. So I noticed that very few people actually understand that, you know, the role digestion and general health plays in performance of activities and stuff like that. So what has been your experience, given your nature of work, you know, in terms of people having indigestion issues and that causing health hazards and affecting sleep and weight gain or other issues?
I mean, it's interesting because, I mean, even when I was training and the people I used to train with, I would notice that, inactivity, nutrition also largely depends on a lot of sugary foods, like some of the gels that are consumed, or people bringing sandwiches with, you know, jam, or consuming like bars that are just sort of energy dense and have a lot of sugar. And I think our focus on how we consume and what we consume, even while we train, has a lot of impact on, on how we are able to deal with some of these things post-training, right? And to that point, now it is believed, I mean, there's a lot of research now that suggests that a lot of chronic diseases and our general well-being is actually affected by our gut health, basically what is called the microbiome, which is sort of healthy bacteria that resides inside our small intestine, right? So, yeah. Well, there are no real definitive answers yet, but there is so much research that is being done on gut health and its relation to diabetes, its relation to CVDs, its relation to obesity, and, just the environment that we live in, right? Even just pollution and things like that also affect our gut health. So I think a lot of this is basically lab science, biomolecular stuff that I don't understand very well. But one thing I can tell you for sure is that nutrition has to be a big part of training for any activity. And if I were you, and since you are a coach, I mean, one suggestion I would definitely have is, one, either you equip yourself with the knowledge, at least some basic knowledge about nutrition, which I am assuming you already do, but importantly, maybe you could hire a nutritionist, right? I mean, it could be sort of a add-on service to what you already offer, and make that a big part of training, because I don't have the statistics on this, but I can tell you from personal experience that with poor nutrition, I don't think you can go very far with training.
Obviously, yeah. So, are there any, I know like many nutritionists start off with a blood test to understand various parameters and stuff like that. Is there some kind of tests that you would suggest that people should do? And in this point, I'm talking not even about training, no, about general health and digestive health and general health. So are there any tests that you would suggest people should start off with, or is it better left to trained nutritionists or doctors?
No, I mean, these are pretty specialized. I mean, actually, you would essentially give you a stool sample, and they would use the stool sample to basically understand what your gut health is like, and then maybe suggest, you know, changes to your diet based off of that. But honestly, I don't know how many people in India, how many hospitals in India offer this kind of testing, and how many nutritionists in India are able to use this kind of information, even if tests like these are available, to then use them and be able to design sort of diet plans for athletes. So my suggestion right now is that is sort of entering a realm that I think is very technical and probably expensive. And unless you are a very serious athlete looking at this at a professional level, where, you know, your daily bread and butter comes from playing the sport, I think you would be better served by following some basic ground rules on what kind of foods you should eat, what kind of foods you should avoid, maybe even maintain a food diary as to understanding how you react to certain foods. Let's say your trainee maintains a food diary over a period of, say, a month, right? And there could be specific days when he is having disturbed sleep or is having gastric trouble. And if he is actually maintaining a food diary, and we can actually find out the days when he is suffering, we may be able to look back and see, was it the training that was causing it? Was it the nutrition that was causing it? Or was it like specific foods in his diet on those days that were causing it? So this has to be a bit of a sort of an exploratory method for us to find out what foods could be probably affecting his sleep, and then begin to avoid them.
Yeah, actually, it's a very simple and cost-effective solution, I would say. Yeah, we can. That's a very simple solution. Yeah. Cool. So I will now go into some of the, you know, so-called hot topics, and have you decide whether it is fact or fiction. So I know a lot of people have, in fact, achieved good results with intermittent fasting with regards to losing weight, as well as they feel that their overall energy levels has improved. And even my partner Krish has had good results with intermittent fasting. So what is your take on IF?
Yeah, I mean, both low carb, high fat diets, or keto diets as they're commonly known as, and intermittent fasting seems to be really the sort of in thing right now. I mean, my view on this, and this is obviously my opinion, is that you know, I'm sort of against using specific weight reduction diets unless there are very specific reasons for which, you know, your GP or a nutritionist is prescribing them for you, right? It is my opinion that looking at blogs online and following diets may really not be the way to go forward. Like I'd spoken about this earlier, things like reduction of not just the fats that you consume, but the kind of fats, which are saturated fats, which are high in cholesterol, that only come from animal sources, avoiding added sugars, reducing the consumption of highly refined carbs, you know, reducing your discretionary calories, things like alcohol, sweets, confectionaries, at the same time substituting all these things with a higher consumption of fruit and vegetable, whole grains, nuts and seeds, is probably what I would suggest is the way to go forward, which is probably encompassed in the Mediterranean style of eating, which is really not a diet, but it is actually a eating pattern, right? Yeah. So what I want to say is there is a difference between a diet and an eating pattern, right? Eating pattern obviously encompasses all the foods that are consumed and all the beverages that are consumed in relation with each other. And that has a, you know, additive effect or a detrimental effect in terms of how those foods are consumed together, right? So the Mediterranean style of eating pattern, as we call it, obviously speaks about consuming fruits and vegetables, whole grains, nuts and seeds, seafood, consumed together along with, you know, exercise, which probably should give you a very balanced lifestyle, right? Mm-hmm. But at the same time, when you speak about IF or, you know, low carb, high fat diets, there is this researcher in England. They have a paper, they've done a study called the DIRECT study, which stands for Diabetes Remission Clinical Trial, where they actually provided about 450, I mean, the study had about 450 people, and about 200 odd people were given an extremely low energy diet, which was about 825 to 850 kilocalories a day for about 3 to 5 months. And they saw that nearly half of the people in the intervention group who received this form of diet were actually able to achieve diabetes remission, right? Mm-hmm. But the important thing here for you to know is that you need to maintain this extremely restrictive lifestyle of consuming just 850 calories through the day to stay in diabetes remission, right? Just to put things in perspective, if you went to Burger King, had a double Whopper burger, a large French fries, and a chocolate milkshake, that would give you 2040 calories. That is more than the recommended calorie intake for an active adult between over the age of 25 in a single meal, right?
Yeah.
And there's there is so much evidence that suggests, which is basically coming out of a lot of US studies, that just 5 to 8% people on weight reduction diets are able to continue them in the long term, are able to maintain their weight loss in the long term, and rest of the 92 to 95% of the people, unfortunately, put it all back on. So, in a long, winded way, I don't see any reason why one must follow intermittent fasting or a keto diet unless there is a medical reason and your GP and a nutritionist to work together to ensure that you are receiving the nutrition that you require. There is isn't enough research that has been done. I mean, there is not enough evidence and data that are available to draw sort of causal inferences at a population level. So nobody at this point in time can make sort of population level recommendations to say that, hey, IF works for everybody or a keto diet works for everybody. This has to be tailored to a specific person having understood their medical history, what their nutritional requirements are, and then think about why this person needs any of these restrictive diet patterns, so to speak, as opposed to consuming a more balanced diet.
Okay. Cool. So, good. Moving on, probably a continuation of the previous question that I had asked about general gut health and stuff. We keep hearing a lot of people talking about or becoming aware of lactose intolerance and gluten allergy these days.
How do we find out if we are having lactose intolerance or allergic to gluten?
What are the impact if we are allergic and we don't realize this?
You know, Gokul, I was just thinking that maybe we should call this episode Controversies in Nutrition Science, because every question you have asked so far are literally the controversies that are going on in nutrition science right now. Like, you can see a lot of news articles or editorials, blog posts that really are asking all the questions that you're asking. So coming back to the question on glucose, let's talk about lactose intolerance and then I can talk about gluten allergies. So basically, our body has this enzyme called lactase that is available in our body aplenty when we are babies, because you're required to get no other nutrition other than mother's milk to the age of 6 months, and then continue with breastfeeding all the way up to 2 years and add on complementary foods, right? So that's what the WHO recommendations are, and there is enough research to support that this is what we should be doing with babies, right? So, but as you grow older, right, from childhood to toddler to teenagers and adulthood, basically this enzyme lactase decreases as you age, right? So, insufficiency of lactase in our body is basically known as primary lactose intolerance, right? Which leads us like abdominal pain, gas, diarrhea, when you consume a lot of lactose. Bloating and gas that you experience is largely due to the bacterial fermentation that happens of the undigested lactose in the large intestine, right? And actually, primary lactose intolerance, what I just described, is, you know, about 75% of the world population has it. It's a fairly common thing, but there are studies that are showing that individuals with, you know, decreased lactase production can still consume things like hard cheese, yogurt, acidophilus milk, and, you know, they'll be fine consuming these things, right? So there is no reason for somebody to be on this highly restrictive, you know, lactose-free diet. And okay, as far as testing goes, it's actually pretty simple. You just need to go to a diagnostic center or a hospital, and then basically they are going to give you a lactose solution, and they're going to draw your blood, because lactose is actually a disaccharide, which is glucose and galactose. So when they test your blood, and if your blood sugars don't spike up, because every time we consume some food, our blood sugars should spike up. And if they don't, your body is unable to break down lactose into glucose and galactose, so your blood sugars don't spike, and this basically establishes that you are lactose intolerant. But obviously, with the caveat that you are also experiencing everything else that I described before, like pain and bloating and diarrhea and things like that.
So, I mean, Just a little bit of confusion here I had was, so are you saying that is there any difference in the way, say, our body processes milk or curd or yogurt as against how it processes cheese and hard cheese and acidophilus milk and stuff?
I mean, the point that I was just trying to make is that unless you have acute situation against lactose, I think most people, like I described, if 75% of the population has some form of lactose intolerance, let's say on a scale of 1 to 10, there are a whole bunch of people who still can consume it safely and not experience some of these, poor outcomes like gas and, you know, diarrhea and bloating and things.
Cool.
And, and your second question was to do with gluten allergy. I mean, gluten allergy, I don't know if it's just fad or fiction. I mean, it's really, really funny with so many people now suggesting that they should consume gluten-free diets, because honestly, gluten allergy presents itself as an immune-mediated disorder called celiac disease, right? It happens primarily in your gastrointestinal tract. And basically, you know, like grains such as wheat and rye and barley, they have this protein called gluten in them, right? And in persons who have celiac disease, right, people who've been diagnosed with celiac disease have these finger-like protrusions in their small intestine called villi, right? And people with celiac disease basically have their villi flattened, and because of that, there is a malabsorption of nutrients. So the food that they're consuming, their body is not able to extract all the nutrients as it would with somebody who does not have celiac disease, right? So those people are probably going to become deficient in micronutrients or become thin, and celiac disease can actually be fatal, right? And celiac disease is actually incurable. The only cure right now that is available is basically to consume a gluten-free diet and maintain yourself, right? I would say about maybe type 2 diabetes, where you just maintain your blood sugar. So that's exactly what happens with celiac disease. But there is this other scenario where people experience celiac disease-like symptoms, and that is called non-celiac gluten sensitivity, right? They are basically sensitive to gluten, similar to how people may be sensitive to lactose, right? And research now shows that there is this thing called FODMAPs, which stands for fermentable oligo, di, and monosaccharides, which are basically different types of carbohydrates that we consume, right? Which are also present in wheat, rye, barley, apples, avocados, you know, broccoli, things like that. And most of the people who think they are actually gluten intolerant are actually probably just non-celiac gluten sensitive and are actually reacting to things like apples and avocados and onions that have FODMAPs and actually are not reacting to gluten itself.
So you mean to say that, you know, it's being confused with the FODMAPs that is available in wheat and the other things like apples and avocado, and it is not really gluten sensitivity.
It's very possible that is what is causing their gluten sensitivity, and it's not really that they have celiac disease, because celiac disease is a serious disorder, right? And it is an immune response. So people with celiac disease have to maintain a gluten-free diet for the rest of their lives. I mean, that is now established. So basically, if you want to know whether you're reacting to FODMAPs or you have some sort of gluten, like how I described the NCGS, non-celiac gluten sensitivity, the best way to check this out is actually using a simple blood test, right? So there's a blood test for celiac disease, and when the blood is tested, you know, there are some antibodies that are produced, right? So people who have celiac disease, when they consume foods that have gluten, right, the body basically views gluten as a threat, right? And the antibodies in your blood increase, right? That is one way to that is the primary diagnosis to say that, okay, so because the markers for I don't know what markers they look for, but I know their markers for antibodies that are looked at, and when the markers go up, you can say that, oh, he probably has celiac disease, right? And then what you need to do is, the way to confirm the diagnosis is actually to do an intestinal biopsy. You have to get an intestinal biopsy done to ensure that, to find out for sure that you actually have celiac disease, which means that you need to be immediately put onto a gluten-free diet, because there is a malabsorption of the nutrients that you've been consuming. So celiac disease is a really, really serious disease, and not to be taken lightly in any way. So if if you have somebody in your family who's been diagnosed with celiac disease, then you should definitely get yourself tested for celiac disease. And people with autoimmune disorders, like diabetes, should definitely have them checked, because 1 in 10 people have the risk of developing celiac disease than compared to people without autoimmune diseases. So a lot of people think that gluten-free diets can, you know, reduce your weight, cure Alzheimer's, cure autism. I mean, you know, that is simply hogwash. I mean, gluten-free diets. So,
okay.
So there is this really good book called The Gluten Lie by this author called Alan Levinowitz, which talks about a lot of these myths in popular culture about foods we consume. It's written in simple English, and anybody even without a science degree should be able to pick it up and read it.
Next question is around detoxification. Whenever while the Indian system of medicine and our background around fasting is all linked to detoxification of the body, but I don't see a lot of support for this, you know, from the Western medicine point of view. What is the science behind this? Is detoxification useful?
I mean, it's an interesting question, because our body is exposed to a lot of xenobiotics, which are basically chemicals that are found in our body and not produced in by our body or in the environment. And these are found basically because of environmental toxins from pharmaceuticals. And our bodies have developed a, you know, sort of a complex enzymatic mechanism to detoxify these substances, right? And there is a lot of variability from person to person, and how the environment, their lifestyles, and their genetic influences deal with these antibiotics in the body, right? There is definitely scientific literature that talks about, you know, impaired detoxification and its association to, you know, cancer and fibromyalgia, Parkinson's disease, and some other immune dysfunction syndromes. So there are a lot of food-based nutrients that are being investigated for their in, you know, modulating these metabolic pathways to enable this detoxification process, right? But most of these are done sort of are clinical studies or animal studies, and there is some, like, popular culture talks about, like, cruciferous vegetables like cauliflower, cabbage, kale, bok choy, broccoli, berries, garlics, even like, you know, spices like turmeric are beneficial and commonly prescribed as naturopathic oriented and functional medicine based therapies. But the truth is that there is an active area of inquiry that continues to happen to reveal these findings on food-based nutrients and their outcomes on health, right? So, you know, commonly we talk about, you know, resveratrol in red wine or grapefruit, which are used as detoxificants, you know. But I think it's important to have somebody who's a trained clinician be able to understand what kind of problem that you have and be able to suggest a detoxification diet than simply look at, you know, blogs and the internet and find these fad detox diets and go on. That would be my suggestion as far as detox diets would go.
Cool. Makes sense. Cool. So I think we have talked a lot about, I did want to ask about nutrition for cyclists, but I think you have covered that already. However, I would like to have your opinion on the role of water and hydration in general health. And of course, we know the importance of water and the cooling mechanisms, especially involved when we dehydrate, the problems of dehydration when we do long activities. But in terms of a general health point of view, how much does water play a role and how important it is for general health?
Actually, it's funny, but when we talk about macronutrients, we just talk about, lipids, fats, carbohydrates, and protein. But honestly, the one macronutrient we need the most is actually water, because water is literally essential for every body activity that our body undertakes. And to maintain homeostasis in our body means so that our body is functioning around a certain balance, water is critical to maintain, your fluids. It's important for your salt balance. So water is critical to what we do. And the recommendations for water are, you see all kinds of numbers, but especially the U.S. National Academies of Science recommends that you need to have about 15 cups of fluid for men. That's about, about 3.5 liters to 4 liters of water a day, and about 2.5 to 3 liters of water for women every day, honestly. And I'm sure that there are a lot of people who don't consume this kind of water, right? And actually, water is a great substitute for any of the energy drinks that a lot of endurance athletes end up consuming, right? They are able to get a lot of their they're able to hydrate themselves with water as effectively, if not better, without all the sugar when they consume energy drinks. So my suggestion as far as water goes is that drinking adequate amount of water is critical for the normal functioning of the body.
Cool. So I'll move on to the last question, and I think it is somewhat connected to your thesis as well. So many of us are parents who are on this podcast, and how do you create awareness of healthy food in children, and what are the foods to reduce or increase in a typical Indian kid's diet?
Gokul, this is like my dissertation, right? I mean, we should spend a lot of time on a podcast just discussing diets in children. Honestly, I mean, we would be doing a big disservice to this topic, because it is something that is very dear to my heart, and something I am extremely interested in going forward, once I'm done with my PhD, to be able to work in this field, especially in India. So having said that, you know, it's important to realize that we as parents, me included, are really the biggest influencers of food choices that our children make, right? We decide what goes into the grocery basket every week or every month. We decide what food is cooked on a daily basis. And there is very little agency that children have. So it is essential that we need to practice what we preach, or at least we need to know enough to be able to practice it, right? So I think that's like a double-edged sword. One is you don't know enough, and even if you know enough, you want to restrict your child's intake while you continue to follow a pretty pretty bad diet yourself, right? So so on that point, I mean, the things that I'd like to say is that, you know, insisting on things like consuming family meals, you know, the child to eat by themselves instead of feeding children, because the child will never know how much they want to eat, because overfeeding can be an issue when you are feeding the child as opposed to when the child is eating themselves. Curtailing snacking frequently is something that you should think about. Learning to read a nutrition facts label, actually that's a really simple thing to do. That's a requirement mandated by all the food that is available. I think FSSAI mandates it. So when you turn around a packet of food that you buy, you should be able to read what's on the label, be able to interpret it, and also be able to teach your child, because information about added sugars, fat content, fiber, energy that it provides, things like that are all featured in there. So it's important for you to learn that. Sugar sweetened beverages could be like fruit juices with added sugars, just cola. Energy drinks are also being produced for children. Things like that should definitely be curtailed. Fried foods that are high in sodium, sugars should be curtailed. And a common thing culturally in a lot of Asian countries is using food as reward. I think we all grew up with that, right? Like, oh, you get 100 on your exam and I'll buy you an ice cream, or, you know, clean up your room and I'll give you a chocolate. So food as reward should be reduced, because the association children make with that is unhealthy foods are rewards that are given when you actually do something good. So it's sort of counterintuitive, right?
Correct.
And then as far as just nutrition for the kids goes, you should definitely think about not overcooking your vegetables. That's definitely a common sight in a lot of Indian families. Providing a lot of diversity in their diets, as opposed to feeding them the same foods day in and day out. Think about colorful plates, red and orange vegetables, green leafy vegetables, introducing your children to new flavors and textures. Even things like Karela, I know it is bitter, but it's a new flavor. And the more you bring up your child, not exposing them to these flavors, the more they are going to grow up to gravitate towards sweeter flavors and saltier flavors, right?
Correct.
So the home food environment really influences the dietary decisions that happen for a child, right? So I think that is something that we all need to look at. We all need to look at what our grocery basket is, what it looks like, and what changes can we make. That's something that we should look at. And the National Institute of Nutrition, which is actually housed in Hyderabad in Karnataka, publishes this food-based dietary guidelines, which is actually meant for sort of nutrition policy making, but they also give out recommendations across the life cycle, means from childhood to adulthood. In fact, the unique thing about Indian food-based dietary guidelines is they disaggregate them by male and female. So you can actually look at the food-based dietary guidelines for children and actually have a sense of, this is obviously steeped in research and evidence-based, right? So you have recommendations on how many cups of fruit and vegetables does a child need on a daily basis, how much carbohydrate he needs to consume, or how many fats should she consume, how many discretionary calories can a child eat. So these are some broad outlines that are given, as opposed to thinking them about, am I meeting the food-based dietary guidelines on a daily basis? Think about it on a weekly basis, right? So if I had a meal that had pizza on Friday night, then ensure that your Saturday is a lot more healthier than it was on Friday, right? So things like that. I mean, these are small nudges that we can make at our homes. And I think they will definitely ensure that your child develops better nutritional habits, because at least the environment we live in is a obesogenic environment with the kind of foods that are available, you know, the lack of physical spaces like parks or, you know, places to cycle or run. The physical environment doesn't support that kind of the physical activity that is required for your child. So changing food habits at home seems to be something, at least at home, seems to be something that is well within our control and something that every parent should look at seriously.
Yeah, I think it's much easier said than done, but knowing what we should do, at least we'll be able to practice some of the things that you mentioned. So I guess that brings us to the end of this podcast. Obviously, a short podcast cannot do justice to this immense topic. It is interesting that this was the first on nutrition in our podcast. So I'm sure a lot of listeners will have more questions, and there are more areas to cover, some areas to be covered in depth, and we'll continue to do so in subsequent episodes. So if you do have any questions, please write to us by email or to podcast@thebikeaffair.com, or you can drop us a message on Facebook as well on our page. Some of the aspects mentioned by Kamal were quite technical, and hence what we thought was we'll include the base transcript of this episode on the show notes, so that if you want to go back and refer, you will be able to do that. And thank you, Kamal, for sharing all your knowledge, and it was quite interesting to learn about the things that you mentioned on this broad topic. So I took a lot of your time, and thank you for that.
Thanks so much for having me, Gokul. And I definitely like to continue on this topic, you know, about nutrition through the life cycle, maybe specific topics related to athletes in particular. And if any of the listeners have questions to be answered or have clarifying questions to things that I've brought up, please share them with me, and then I can definitely send back a reply, and then you could share it with the listeners.
Sure, I will do that, Kamal. Thanks a lot, and we'll catch up again on probably some other time in a different episode.
Yep. Thanks so much, Gokul.